All right, if you're in this room, you are here for Scheme Update 7, WorkSafe ACT, Return to Work SA, and ComCare, if that's not where you'd like to be. You can make a discreet exit now, or when the lights go down, but I don't think they're going down. Look, we've got a great session here. It's going to be pretty exciting. Hopefully it helps you digest that lunch you just had and the ice creams that followed up. And if you didn't get one, unlucky, they were just outside the room. You could also quickly, discreetly dash out and grab one now to enjoy during the session if you like. We're really lucky today. We're joined by Hannah Alnajab, Hanson Chen, and Michael Francis. Michael's the Chief Executive Officer of Return to Work SA, Workers' Comp, underwriting Workers' Comp for the private sector, commercial sector in South Australia, and also regulator across the state for workers' compensation. Hannah's a senior director in data analytics and finance for ACT government. Super interesting there. It's covering both their private sector, privately underwritten scheme, but also covering their self-insurance under the SRC Act for public sector employees, which gives her a really unique perspective here across two very distinct schemes. And last but certainly not least, Hanson Chen is the Director of Premiums and Cost Recovery at ComCare, covering APS employees across Australia, as well as ComCare being a regulator for numerous self-insurers across Australia as well. Order of proceedings here. Each of Hannah, Hanson and Michael are going to give a brief 5-minute overview about where their scheme's at. We're going without a wire here, without a safety wire here. We're going to go without slides so we can really engage. But you can start your questions flowing through straight away if you like during these updates. We do want it to be as much of a conversation as possible. I've obviously got some pre-prepared ones, but if we don't get to them, that would be a real pleasure. Because they're not true. No, they're fine. So let's work down the line. Perhaps we start with you, Hannah, if you'd like to give us a quick update on where ACT is at.
Hello, everybody. I'm hoping the sound is coming out okay. Thanks, Ash, for that introduction, and I'm glad to be here to be sharing a bit of information about both our private sector underwritten scheme and the self-insurance experience under the ComCare scheme or the SRC Act. On the private sector side, we're seeing that claim numbers are generally increasing, but with some real wage growth, there's the frequency experience is subdued, so overall a bit of stability there. In terms of payments, we are seeing stability in weekly and legal payments, but there's some increases in the medical and the rehab spend. We're actually considering the rehab spend a positive improvement, and you could see the return on investment there with the stability in the weekly payments. So achieving some real good return to work outcomes as well. In terms of the disputation, as you might know, the underwritten scheme in the ACT has uncapped access to common law, so it's definitely sensitive to changes in disputation trends, and lump sum claim numbers are stable or actually a bit lower than historical levels, but claims the payments are increasing. Inflation and other trends, that's expected, but we're really looking at the experience of the lower than history disputation numbers very positively. And in terms of premium rates, that really translates to a risk premium rate of around 1.26%. Historically, that has been around 1.3 to 1.6, so definitely a reduction compared to history. And then it translates to a reasonable premium rate of around 2.04, which is slightly higher than last year, but still below the achievable rate. Achievable rates, on average, have been around 2.18, so 2.2 almost. And recently, we've actually been very pleased to have introduced one of the nation's first crisis payments into the scheme. It's a scheme that looks at providing payments to dependents in the case of fatality, very quick access. It's capped, so it's capped around 10,000 for the partner and 5,000 for dependents. And one of the things that I think was really positive in this is an ability to be creative and using essentially resident status for proxy for dependency to ease that access and speeding up of the payments. We've also seen or have recently introduced a number of legislative changes in the work health and safety space. A lot of them have been just really as part of national harmonization with national laws and some strengthening in terms of notifiable incident requirements. On the public sector side, overall the numbers have been stable. We moved to self-insurance in 2019. And since then, we've actually been able to achieve significant reduction in our premiums. So currently sitting around 1.8%. That compares to almost to 4.6% back in 2015-16. So a significant reduction there really in the premiums. And an ability to achieve that has really been through unlocking a lot of initiatives in the prevention space, but also in terms of the work rehabilitation. I'll be happy to talk about that a bit later as well. And then in terms of legislative environment for us in the private, in the public sector space, we're really anticipating what comes out of the SRC review. If you're following that, 110 recommendations, a lot of them touch into the entitlements, but are also expected to have potential impacts on the claims administration model, which is going to be very significant for us, given that we essentially operate under a delegated claims administration model. That was really it for me.
Great. Thank you, Hannah. Look, thanks. First of all, thanks everyone for having me here. Perhaps I'll start with a little bit of background about ComCare, just in case there's someone in the audience who's not familiar with what ComCare does. ComCare is essentially responsible for two main things, first of which is the it acts as the regulator that monitors and enforces the WHS Act. Secondly, it's also responsible for the administration of the Safety, Rehabilitation and Compensation Act, so the SRC Act, like Hannah mentioned previously. Under that act, ComCare has about 180 federal government agencies that we directly insure, but it also has issued licenses to about 40 licensees. So most of these licensees are either ex-government entities or large corporations that have footprints across multiple jurisdictions, so examples of which include Telstra, Commonwealth Bank, NAB, and of course, formerly the ACT government as well. So a little bit on where the scheme is at in 2025. FTE-wise, it covers about 490,000 employees, with 230,000 of those being Australian Public Service employees and 260,000 of those belonging to licensees. There has been quite a bit of growth in recent years in the public sector segment of it. I think the growth over the last 2 years was about close to 15%. And then there's also been growth in the self-insured part of the scheme, but it's much lower at about 5% over the last 2 years. A little bit about our premium rate. So it's for the current financial year, it's 0.98%. So still under 1%, which is our preferred target. It is still a very affordable scheme, in Australia. And it has been under 1% since about 2019. So it has been, roughly around the, under the 1% range for quite a sustained period of time. But we do see some pressures rising. We're not a particularly large scheme, particularly when compared to Victoria, New South Wales, or even South Australia. We have about $1.8 billion in terms of liabilities that forms part of the premium scheme. So a bit more of a snapshot in terms of our financial sustainability. Our funding ratio is 120%. As of the 30th of June 2005, ComCare actively targets a range of 110% to 125%, so that is comfortably within that range. And it has been around that range and above that range over the last decade or so. Some emergent pressures that we're seeing happening in the scheme. So I previously talked about the premium rate being under 1%. So there's been a fairly sustained decline over the last decade from a rate that was pretty close to 2% down to what at its lowest point was about 0.8%. One of the main drivers for that is that we've seen quite a sustained decline in physical injury and physical disease claims. However, that rate has since increased in recent years, and that's mainly due to a plateauing of the decline that we've seen in positive claims experience as a result of declining physical physical injury and disease, but a sustained continued increase in psychological claims. We anticipate that these pressures around psychological claims will persist into the near future, which is why if you look at our renewed strategy as of 2024-25, the top two core pillars of ComCare strategy is to improve prevention of workplace injuries and also to ensure that more focus is placed on returning people to work when they've been injured. So the prevention and the returning to work of, ensuring that workplaces are safer and as much as possible free of psychosocial risks, and returning people to work once they have suffered a psychological injury is going to be extremely important, at least in the coming years for ComCare, in order to ensure that not only to ensure that the scheme remains sustainable from a financial and prudential point of view, but also to ensure that Australian workplaces are as safe and as risk-free as possible. So that's just a quick overview of ComCare in 2025, and look forward to answering some of your questions. And over to Michael.
Thanks, Hanson. Hi, everybody. So thanks again for your time. So I'm going to give you just a quick snapshot of what's happening at Return to Work SA, then over to questions. So and get into some of the juicier stuff after that. But I guess the overall message is that we're in a reasonably stable state, and I know that whilst that's not necessarily been a common theme of the last couple of days, at least in terms of where some of the other jurisdictions are, I don't know, yours are actually travelling quite well here as well. I think an element to tease out before I get into the substance of our numbers, and it was alluded to by Ash in the introduction, is that within the South Australian scheme, the Crown agencies, aka all of your police, education, corrections and whatnot, are all self-insured. So we are insuring, as a registered scheme side of things, purely the private sector in that sense. And the private sector minus, I guess, slight change in the dynamic, is the relatively large number of self-insured employers within our scheme. So a really critical element of that, and it's not it's no surprise, everyone understands the extent that psychological injury claims are placing pressures on other schemes, and that's just not something that's been part of our environment, which is a little bit odd for some to hear about, and I'm sorry for those of you who are in the middle of it for whom it is the case. But I think there's a few pieces to that, not least of which the fact that, as I understand what's happening in most of the jurisdictions, the lion's share of that psychological injury claims pressure comes out of the public sector agencies. And so the self-insurance element, I'm happy to talk to a little bit more. I think there's maybe something in that in terms of even the experience being felt within the self-insured sector that doesn't seem to be quite as great as far as those things are concerned. But legislatively, we've got a couple of elements which help us as well. We have, since the 1st of July 2015, had a relatively high criteria for people to be able to enter the scheme for psychological injury, and that in so much as work needed to be the significant contributing factor, as opposed to a simple sort of difference from a word sense, but quite a significant difference with respect to the clarity you can establish around your entry criteria, and the fact that there's no lump sums attached to psychological injury in our scheme. And so when you put these things together, it's part of, I think, the dynamic which has led to, it's not the only elements, I think we do quite a lot in the preventative space as well, but they're really important parts of what's kept our scheme somewhat immune to some of the broader pressures that are going on more broadly, albeit we're not taking that for granted at any point. It's been, again, alluded to in the few minutes we've been in here, the introduction of relevant new regulations, codes of practice as it relates to prevention of psychological hazards in workplaces or reduction of those hazards has been accompanied by increases in claim numbers in nigh on every other jurisdiction they've been introduced in. They've been introduced in South Australia recently. We're not seeing that same degree of pressure as far as what's happening from psychological injury claims. So don't get me wrong, there are some increases, but not anything that feels remotely out of control or causing problems. So with that sort of put to one side, I think it's a really important piece of context. The scheme's performance in more recent times is quite stable again. For those of you who had any interest in our scheme, about 5 years ago we had somewhat of a shock. We had a legal decision that came down which basically, if left unmitigated from a legislative standpoint, would have given us about an extra $1 billion worth of liability overnight. Through some of the legislative change, that was halved to about $500 million, but it introduced the concept of people being able to effectively combine elements of impairment more so than previously, which had all sorts of other behavioural ramifications that needed to be worked through in terms of just what that meant from a risk base as well. And so all that said, we took a bit of a hit from a funding perspective, but the pleasing element throughout all of that is the operations of the scheme of such have been quite stable in so much as we've been achieving really, I'll say, particularly at the moment, we're maintaining sort of best historical return to work levels, remain at and return to work levels. Our number of open disputes is at the lowest level in the last 7 or 8 years. And from a premium setting and costs perspective, and again, to put it all into perspective, we're about a 16,000 claim a year scheme, 63,000 odd employers, about just under $5 billion in liabilities overall. And we're charging 1.85%. That's the same level we've been at for the last 3 years, and that was introduced at the time of that funding, I'll say that shock, I guess, of sorts that came from that off the back of that legal decision. But that 1.85% exceeds our break-even, which is at 1.72 in the last year or so. So we're back to full funding over the last couple of years after that shock brought us down into the low 90s in that sense. So broadly speaking, as I say again, we feel as though we're in a reasonably stable position. That said, we do have we have pressures like any other scheme in terms of what they look like. Happy to go into more of those later, but certainly, if I was to say there's a couple of those that really stand out. We've had the introduction of a new set of impairment assessment guidelines that became effective from the 1st of October. From my understanding of most schemes, more hangs off impairment assessment in our scheme in terms of access to particular levels of entitlement, and pretty significant difference in the overall implications for the liability and scheme costs more broadly that flow from that. And given there's some changes within that which our scheme actuaries are a little bit nervous about, albeit they're intended to be cost neutral, it's a bit of a proviso that we put on our financial position at any given point in time, that a lot will depend upon how the implementation of those changes to our impairment assessment guidelines play out. For those of you who really want to get into the detail, a lot of that comes back to tests in and around chronic regional pain syndrome and access to that and how all that plays out. So that's us.
Excellent. Well, maybe we stick on that for the moment, because you amongst, I mean, this panel is almost this is the workers' compensation schemes that are currently in pretty good form, in pretty good space panel. So let's reflect and pick on, you know, the strength that you have at the moment and what the threats are. And you mentioned one there. Is there anything else, Michael, that you see on the horizon?
I guess I'll sort of come to the strengths in a moment, but the other threats. This is, you know, forgiveness from the politicians around the place, but we've got an election coming up early next year, so I think there's a degree to which one of the, there's always sort of, I'll say, a corollary to any situation you're in. One of the upsides of being in a good position is being in a good position. The downside is you go into an election and your politicians potentially feel like there's something to give away, And you take for granted some of the disciplines and elements of what got you into that position in the first instance. We put onto the back of that, we at the time of the changes that were introduced to deal with the legal decision I referred to back in 2021, there was a commitment made to having a scheme review in 2027. And so we've got a scheme review coming up plus an election. So in and of itself, with money in the bank, so to speak, there's a risk that that might be part of what can be seen to be able to be given away, but inherent tensions and how you manage those in a scheme are critical, and there can be lots of unintended consequences. We're fortunate to have a set of political masters who are willing to listen. We've got good rapport with, but lots can change in lead-ups to elections and things like scheme reviews. So that's definitely a point of threat, and I guess a very specific operational one, noise-induced hearing loss. It might be a small part of most of our schemes, but it's become an increasingly significant one, which for the first time in a long time in our schemes become more material as it relates to what our break-even premium looks like. We seem to have, through some of what we've done in recent times, managed to at least put a temporary, I'll say, hold on the rate of increase in terms of what was happening there, but we're under no illusions about the level of intuition and ingenuity that can be shown by those in pursuit of a few bucks in that space. So.
Oh, excellent. And I guess there's a... I mean, to contrast, I guess, with Comcare, because both in pretty strong positions at the moment, South Australia has come out of post-Summerfield decision of a fair amount of uncertainty and in pretty good form post those reforms. Comcare, on the other hand, Hanson, I mean, it's, what are we, 35 years with any... like, in the context of Australia, some fairly minimal reforms, I guess. It's been a fairly consistent scheme for 35 years. What are your reflections on that and the strengths and the threats to it?
Yeah, thanks, Ash. Probably the first thing I want to kind of mention is that at least over the past decade, the scheme has been fairly stable. And one of the key reasons is that there hasn't been any dramatic structural changes to the Act itself. So there hasn't been any structural changes to the scheme. I think that's one of the biggest factors that's influencing this this very stable period. The second thing that might explain why our premium has trended down is how our premium model works. So we're a little bit unique in that we have 180 agencies and we employ a model that effectively risk adjusts for the actual experiences of each of these agencies. So as soon as an agency has poor experience, depending on how severe that experience is, it can be very quickly reflected in the premiums. So that gives a certain level of impetus. Of course, it's not the only level of impetus for agencies to who wish to manage their premiums to focus more on what they're doing in terms of prevention and returning to people to work. So that's the second aspect. And finally, I think I mentioned previously that Comcare targets a ratio, a funding ratio of 110 to 125%. So at least in some of those years in the last decade, when the funding ratio does go above 125%, Comcare has the option of granting a discount to premiums of up to 10%. And certainly in some of those years, Comcare has reduced agency premiums, all premiums by 10% over some of these years because our funding ratio has exceeded the 125% top end. So I think those are the three factors that has enabled Comcare's premium rate to stay between, you know, the 0.8 and 1% range over the last decade.
Excellent. And it's almost a too good opportunity to resist because Hannah, ACT public sector is working under the same act. And on exit, you mentioned a pretty significant reduction in 2019 when you exited from the premium scheme to self-insurance. Maybe you'd like to reflect on that.
Thanks, Ash. I mean, I think there was a number of reasons for that decision. The ACT government, I think, has the interest in having being able to influence the claims administration model and to do a bit more in the rehabilitation, probably one of the biggest drivers for that, but also the premium management as well, would maybe venture to say that maybe the drop around 2019 in the Comcare premium was a result of our exit. But I think, you know, I think it's the ACT jurisdiction or the government is relatively small in size. We were covering around 30,000 employees. But the broadness or the breadth of the services provided, ranging from municipal services to, government, traditional government roles, first responders, healthcare, education. It's a really diversified risk profile, but also one with significant concentrations in terms of like public service delivery. So being able to respond to that, or being able to match our service model to that unique risk profile, I think has been working well for us under self-insurance. We are up for license renewal, it's an interesting proposition to go through in terms of also understanding the Commission's view on how the ACT government has fared under self-insurance. The length of that license is one that we probably are also seeing some uncertainty around, and would like to see it, have longer and longer periods, just to provide that certainty for us and for the claims administrators that we would be working with. So there are always a bit of uncertainty, I guess, under the SRC scheme as a self-insurer, like not necessarily just as under itself, the SRC scheme, where you are subject to legislative changes. And the SRC review definitely is a big one or a big uncertainty at the moment, given that there hasn't been any significant changes in the scheme for quite some time. There's also probably some elements of the, like, in the intricacies of it. There's the oversight and having to adapt to a different oversight model as a self-insurer has been a good journey, and it has pushed the ACT government to build some centralized functions to support that, especially around the work health and safety management, and to essentially invest into a work health and safety management that. Management system that crosses over the service with that breadth of risks underlying it. The self-insurance model has allowed us to actually build that system with those risks in mind, and enable some significant initiatives around prevention, and particularly around psychological injury prevention that. respond to the increasing injury rate in public service for psychological injury, particularly for first responders. There is a lot of investment around awareness and removal of stigma, but there's also initiatives that would that are targeted around easier access to services and enabling different models, including online trainings and access to different service providers for that early intervention as well. So I think to wrap that up, maybe I think the overall operating as a self-insurer under the SRC scheme has been has had a positive outcome for the ACT government. We manage a healthy balance sheet as well. Our funding ratio sits around 140%, which is adding to the government's own balance sheet as well, which is really another positive outcome of that. And but I think the future has a bit more uncertainty. What really happens in terms of psychological prevention is really going to be significant. A lot of what we have achieved in terms of improvements are improvements that, if they're not sustained, would have a significant impact on the reserving and the liability numbers. And translating that into premiums would definitely put on pressures on the government budget as well. We're comfortable with the position that we are in now, and I think we're continuing to working with the different partners, including Comcare and the Commission. It's not unusual to have these cycles in these schemes.
Fantastic. And maybe we stay on the topic of psychological injuries and psychological hazard for a moment with a question from the floor. We're hearing a lot of workers' compensation schemes talk about focus on psychological hazard reduction off the back of law reforms in particular. Pragmatically, how do you see this working in practice? changing entrenched cultures associated with certain industries and whatnot. Anyone can kick off there, but you're welcome to, Hannah.
I probably have already covered it, but we'll leave the maybe Michael.
Yeah, I'm happy to have a go at that. Look, it's very important, but also very challenging. I think if you look at a physical, physical injury or disease, it's, due to its nature, it's very clear. So your arm's either broken or not, whether you can either use your arm or not. Whereas with psychological injuries, because it's internal, it's much more difficult to kind of identify and treat. And I think this whole field is still relatively nascent compared to, the more traditional physical injuries. I think I previously mentioned that this is going to be, the trend of increasing psychological claims is going to put financial or prudential pressure, at least on Comcare scheme, but more broadly as well. But I think it's also important to kind of look at the flip side as well. There are some positive aspects of those rising numbers. If you think back, perhaps even, two or three decades ago, psychosocial hazards and psychological claims weren't even really that much of a thing. They're much higher now. Why? Because people have identified those risks. So these risks have always existed, right? So they've always happened. It's only more recently that people have identified them and is now beginning to think about ways to treat them. My view, having worked in strategy for most of my life, I tend to think, the first step in a good strategy is, you correctly identify and articulate your problem. And I think the sector has certainly done a great job in doing that. The next step is obviously trying to find solutions. And look, it is at the beginning of the step. So one example that comes to mind that Comcare has done in recent times is New Access, which is previously New Access, which is a pilot, and now currently run by Beyond Blue as Before Blue. It's a program, it's an early intervention program. It is self-selected, so if you work for one of the agencies that are under the program, you can self-nominate as an employee to go into the program. It's been extremely successful. 98% of participants express satisfaction with the program, and 88% have said, they've seen their productivity improve as a result of the program. Now, I am conscious that it is by self-selection, so there's probably a little bit of there's a little bit of bias there. But I think, in terms of early intervention programs, these are the kind of things that we're likely to see in the coming years. Innovative approaches to prevention, as well as ways to encourage people to return to work after they've suffered from, a psychological injury at work.
Oh, Wayne. And the first comment in response to the question is that we have to acknowledge there's a degree to which there's only so much we can do in work injury insurance schemes. There's a broader societal issues that are being bitten off as far as those things are concerned. But that said, I think there is no other way that, I guess, that doesn't mean we don't do anything. And I think in terms of elements where I see at least green shoots of success in terms of those interventions are those where we actually get out there and get involved with others. We can't try and deal with this on our own. So when I say get involved with others, and there's certainly elements of what we try to do within South Australia, acknowledging it's a smaller community and it's easier to hit critical mass in terms of engagement with your broader employer community and with unions and how all that comes together in terms of what's the broader programs of work you have in play to try and make sure that you're engaging and at least giving people with a desire and want to try and do things better the capacity and capability to do those things in an informed way. And with one of the things that we have been able to do is build really strong relationships both with industry and with particular unions and make sure that we're developing our own capability from a risk management perspective, not from just a straight up safety perspective, which tends to be a bit more compliance orientated. We know that things like regulations and codes of practice can be important to a degree, but I would argue on their own don't actually do what you need to have done. They're an element, but in some respects, like we've seen around jurisdictions, it leads to increases in claim numbers in terms of how, and I get that that's early, but how do you actually get people to engage? And it's got to be a holistic approach that involves that broader community engagement, and you've got to be prepared to get active in terms of how all that plays out, but as well as from a risk management standpoint, the work that's done to identify those particular industries where you see an increased incidence and where, what can you do in terms of engaging very specifically with all the tools that are in our kit to try and borrow, beg, steal, force those particular organisations and industries to get involved. And even if you have to use the powerful incentives of money and premium and all those sorts of things, but typically the conversations that are had don't have to revert to that, and we've had degrees of success in terms of the programs where, or I guess those industries in particular, where we can hit, admittedly within a smaller jurisdiction, critical mass and make somewhat of a difference. So
excellent, and keep questions coming through. And everyone's always also welcome to, there's a microphone in the middle if you'd like to jump up and ask a question.
So short answer is too early. Can't really see much at all. And sorry for the rest of the people in the room. Section 18 in our Act is about employers' obligation to provide suitable employment following a work injury. And what does that look like? And there was some strengthening of that recently through some amendments made. And in particular, those that strengthening related to particularly larger organisations where the obligation to provide suitable employment extended beyond just the specific entity within a larger corporation in terms of their obligation to provide suitable employment, particularly for the Crown agencies, though. That basically means if you work for the South Australian Government and you work in, I don't know, corrections or wherever it might be, and you can't return, and there's nothing they can find for you more broadly, well, then there's a whole lot of other government agencies that they've got responsibilities to try and coordinate what something different might be and look like for you, as well as the imposition of a requirement on a host employers who are using labour hire to, well, the words that are used are cooperate, I think, with the provision of return to work obligations and how all that all plays out. So it's, yeah, long story short is that they're quite strong in terms of that broader Section 18 obligations on employers in South Australia, having been in some different jurisdictions previously relative to what I've seen elsewhere, and this just strengthened it further. So,
fantastic. Any questions from the floor? I think we're starting to run a little low on time, so any more from the floor? No? Well, I might ask perhaps one more. I'm interested in your thoughts on effective case management. In particular, I get excited every year when schemes release their actuarial reports and annual reports. And if you look at South Australia, for instance, the claims management expenses seem high relative to elsewhere, but it's a very distinct model. And I'm wondering if you want to comment on that and your thoughts in that and what benefit you get from your specific model as well.
Very happy to talk to it. And the service model, most people know about our mobile orientated model, where those higher risk claims receive face-to-face interaction. And it's a high-performance, expensive tool. There's no question about that, but we believe that there's significant return on investment. And if I was to say there's one thing that's underpinned some of the more recent, I think, stable, better performance for our scheme, the service model's part of it, but it's been a recognition of the importance of investing in, at an industry level, in progressive capability build of that group. Because you can, so for example, with our 16,000 claims a year, we had over 30,000 face-to-face engagements within the scheme. And so we understand a lot more than we used to about the importance of the timing of those engagements, the nexus between the timing of that engagement and the size of caseloads. We understand a lot more about what tenure, in particular mission-critical roles, and what the capability level of the capability profile of people in those roles looks like across our respective claims agents and how that comes into being. If you'd asked me 5 or 6 years ago, we had nowhere near that level of sophistication in our understanding. but it's enabled us to progressively lift the capability of that group, because that's in and of itself what underpins the success of that service model, is the capability of the people who are providing it. Because at times where we had high levels of turnover and very little understanding, and you basically just measure it, and at least that's the first step in what's happening there, we weren't performing as well. But as we've refined that over time and we've invested in it and we can see the build occur, the results come with it, and it requires a very different relationship with our claims agents, which I think it works well in terms of just how all that plays out, because it's no good to us, for example, in a scheme that uses two claims agents, to have one going swimmingly and another from a capability and tenure perspective having a whole lot of difficulty, because as the ultimate underwriters and risk bearers, we still see drop-offs in performance as far as that's concerned. So we feel that the way in which our claims team, our capability teams are working together with our claims agents to better understand, that's absolutely underpinning, I guess, the strength of that service model.
Fantastic. And we're well out of time. There could be loads more questions we could ask, but I'm sure outside the room or wherever, Michael, Hannah, Hans would be happy to discuss the claims management models, maybe, you know, those who work in the East Coast and some of the public sector workers' compensation schemes that have undergone a bit of grief. Talk to Hannah and Hansen about what self-insurance under ComCare looks like, and how is it so successful. No comment is probably the answer, but if you could all put your hands together, Hannah, Michael and Hansen, that'd be great.